Welcome to my platform, metro.co.uk's new podcast, where we speak to the authors of some of our first person and opinion sections, most read articles of the past few years. My platform is all about drawing attention to underheard and underrepresented voices in the media talking about issues close to their heart. Hosted by me, Jess Austin. I edit a section of Metro that all of our lovely guests submitted their pieces to. As well as being among the most popular articles, they're also some of my absolute favourites, and I can't wait to speak to the authors more about what inspired their articles unhindered by a pesky word count. In this series, we'll be having thought-provoking discussions about issues like the pension gap, pretty privilege, and the problematic side of fake tanning. We'll also be shining a light on people's lived experience, covering adoption, HIV diagnoses, and finding love after loss. This week, we're welcoming Ellie Harrison to the podcast. Today, we're going to be discussing her piece, I Was 21 When I Found Out I Had HIV from an at-home STI test. Hi, Ellie, how are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thank you. Glad to be here.
Thanks so much for coming on the podcast. I thought your story that you wrote for us last year was just really incredible, and I was really excited to get to speak to you more about it. Firstly, can you tell me a bit about yourself and your story?
Yeah, so I'm currently 26 and I've recently moved to Manchester. But before that, I was living in Birmingham. I'd done my studies there and I stayed after. And then I was diagnosed with HIV when I was 21.
And what was life like before you got your diagnosis?
Pretty normal, I think, for most 21-year-old girls. I was just about to go to my final year of university. So I was having a lot of like partying, fun and frolicking around. But just a very generic normal life.
And had you known anything really about HIV at this point?
I know at school I definitely had sex education about it, but I think because I'm classed as not being really an at-risk group, it was never something I'd really researched into or had a lot of background knowledge on.
Yeah, you mentioned in your piece that I think Steve from Hollyoaks was your one reference of HIV.
Yeah, because I'm like obviously in the straight white community, I don't really know anyone with HIV. Even now after I've lived with it for 5 years, I don't really know people other than the people I've gone out to find. So the only thing I could remember is watching Hollyoaks as a kid and he getting diagnosed. And this was like years after when I got my diagnosis. So I was like, well, he's fine, so I'm going to be fine.
Yeah, I think my actual first experience of really understanding HIV was also a Hollyoaks storyline years before you. I think it was Mercedes's husband, could be misquoting this now, had HIV. And I went into a sex ed lesson being like, oh, but you can have kids when you have HIV because this guy's done that and he's done this. And like the teacher being like, I didn't know Hollyoaks was talking about that. But that's great that you had that reference. But as you say, when you got your diagnosis, you're a little bit in the dark about it. So like hopefully most 21-year-olds, you took an at-home STI test for being sexually active. Was this because you were feeling unwell or just because it's important to be on top of your sexual health?
I actually had no idea. I didn't think I had anything. I was just in between partners and I was like 2 weeks off going to Freshers Week for final year. So I kind of thought it's a sensible thing to do. It's what I should be doing. So I just ordered a test to be delivered to my house.
Right. And what was the test like? What did it involve?
So my test was basically for every STI. So you've got a couple of swabs, one you do in your throat and then obviously one you do downstairs. And then there's a little vial of blood. You prick your finger, milk your blood into it, and then you just send it off in the post. And you normally get a text about 1 to 2 weeks later.
And what happened next for you?
So I didn't get a text, which is always the concerning sign. I got a phone call to say, can you come into this clinic in Birmingham? At the time on the phone, they didn't really tell me anything. They just advised me to come in. And I think naively in my head, I was like, oh, I've got chlamydia. I'd gone in to the hospital. And when I got there, the nurse was quite like, not stern, but very serious. And she basically told me at the time I had something called what they call a false positive. So she went through the fact that it was definitely looking like it was HIV, but it was really common with some of these tests. It's the way the blood is transported. It's if you don't clean your hands properly, it can flag a lot of random things. And the best thing for us to do is just get a vial of blood from the arm, send it off for a proper test. But at the time, she reassured me that it's very unlikely that I had it.
And so how did you feel kind of when she first said the news, but then also once she offered you the reassurance, did you feel like, oh, I definitely don't have this, you know, I don't fall into the at-risk groups?
Yeah, so when I'd gone in immediately, I'd had text a couple of my friends because I was quite worried, but I kind of left that appointment and we went on a big night out after and I was joking about it. I was like, as if I'd convinced myself I've got HIV, there's no chance that could happen. And we all made a big joke of it for this entire evening.
And so did you know going into the appointment that you were there to discuss HIV, or was it once you got there that she sat you down? And also, how long did it take after you submitted your tests to get an appointment?
Yeah, so I didn't know it was HIV. I knew one of the test results had flagged, but I didn't know which one it was. So I got this call I got was about 2 weeks after when I'd done the home test. But when they were obviously on the phone, they said, come in immediately. So I think it was at 11 o'clock and I was in the clinic by lunch.
So what happened after you were given this false positive, or what, told you had a false positive? You gave your vial of blood. What happened after that?
Yeah, so about a week after that, I was at work and I never normally have my phone with me at work. So I'd gone on my lunch break and I had 40 missed calls from a hospital number. And I was like, this seems concerning. So I called the number back, explained who I was, and I had these calls. And they said, you need to get immediately to a clinic. And at that point, I guess I knew and I'd figured out that I definitely had it. So the clinic was about 30 minutes from where I was at the time. In that time frame, I'd called my parents immediately and said, look, you need to get to Birmingham. And I've gone to this appointment entirely on my own. I hadn't even walked in the door and I obviously knew what she was going to tell me.
And how did you kind of mentally prepare for that? And what was the first thing you said to the nurse or doctor, if you can remember?
I actually dropped a cup of coffee as I walked in the room, which is like the worst thing to do at the worst time, because I felt such like a burden. But I couldn't sit. I basically went into full panic. I didn't want to sit down. I just wanted to know. I think hearing the words, you're HIV positive, for me would start a journey. And as soon as she said that, I just went into overload. I was incredibly distressed. I was crying. I had a panic attack. They advised me not to leave the clinic. They wanted to wait until my parents got there so someone could come and be with me. But unfortunately, my parents were like 3.5 hours away still. So the nurse went through this level of detail of what the next week was going to look like for me, that I'd have to go to a specialist HIV center the next day and kind of get on treatment or get some more blood tests done. And then she did reassure me at the time, all the positive things that you have about HIV now, that there is medication, you can take treatment. But on that day, none of it went in.
Yeah, I bet. And aside from STI, you know, a lot of people, we grew up societally with stigma on HIV. What kind of things did you believe about the illness before you educated yourself better after your diagnosis?
I think it's a really common thing for when people first get diagnosed to use the word dirty. And it's thrown around quite a lot. And I know that's how I felt. I genuinely felt like the dirtiest person in the world. I'd had this understanding that for some reason, because statistically I wasn't the person that should be getting a HIV diagnosis, I'd convinced myself that I'd done something wrong in my life to deserve it. And I kind of really worked myself into this hole of like, this has all happened for a reason. This was meant to be happening to me. And I think you just really boil it down to no one's ever going to be with me again. So there's just this big pit of fear of how do you continue to live the rest of your life when I didn't even want to be with myself.
And did you vocalise this to the nurse and doctor at the time, or did you keep it to yourself?
So it wasn't until the next day when I went to the specialist HIV clinic. I think at that point, I still thought this was all a joke. I kind of thought this test results were going to be wrong. And when I got to this HIV clinic, they said I had to do another test. So my head's gone, well, if I'm being tested again, it's because they don't 100% know I've got it, which wasn't the case at all. It's just a formality you have to go through at a new doctor's. So I had to do another prick test, but this one was the rapid active one. So you basically prick your finger and 30 seconds later, you get a result. So we've pricked my finger and I made the nurse do it about 3 or 4 times because every time it came back positive, I was like, this isn't happening to me. This definitely isn't happening to me. But then that clinic basically coddled me and gave me the most love and support I ever needed, went through absolutely everything I needed to know to be okay. I think most people sit on either one end of the spectrum. You either want to know everything about it or you want to know nothing. And I was very much on the side that I had to know absolutely everything about this virus to make sure that I was going to be okay.
Absolutely. And you phoned your parents, but you said you need to get to Birmingham immediately. When did you tell them you were HIV positive? How did they react? You mentioned that your mum received support from the Terence Higgins Trust. What happened next?
Yeah, so when I called my parents after I'd had all these missed calls, I said to them, I think I've got HIV. And my mum was joking down the phone being like, no, it would just be chlamydia, don't worry. So they were very supportive. I think, unfortunately, they'd been at an 80s festival all weekend. So they were also violently hungover and on a 3-hour drive. So I don't think they're in the best of moods. But they did on the way there. My parents obviously grew up in the 80s. And I think they also had no knowledge of what HIV is like now. So they needed to make sure that by the time they got to me, I think they were not worried about the fact they knew nothing. They were worried about how upset I was and arriving and saying something to make it worse. So my mum called Terence Higgins, and everyone asked my parents now, like, how did they know to call them? And my dad says he just remembers from back in the 80s, it was always like it was signposted everywhere that Terence Higgins would be able to help. And they did give my parents the most wonderful advice. I think they stayed on the phone for most of that 3-hour journey and told them everything that they needed to tell me or do to make me feel better.
And so what was it like when you saw your parents when they arrived? What kind of reaction, you know, how did that lesson from Terence Higgins Trust really help them and help you?
Yeah, it was quite a weird experience because I basically cried for 3 hours until they got there. I'd made a decision that when my mum and dad arrived, I didn't want to make it worse for them. I think they knew how distressing the situation was. So I tried to put on a brave face and not cry. So they took me to the pub because it's the only thing you do in this situation, right? Go to the pub. And we just chatted about anything and everything other than the fact I'd just been told I had HIV. And I think that's what I needed. It was the only thing I could think about. And the last thing I need to do is talk about it constantly. And then my dad kept making a lot of jokes. So the whole time we're at the pub, he's there going, oh, just stay positive. Which at the time probably wasn't that funny, but looking back is hilarious.
It's great that they were so, you know, instantaneously knew how to settle you and what you needed to know. That's brilliant. And so can you tell me a bit about your treatment plan? I mean, part of this podcast as well is I want to help smash the stigma around HIV. So what was your treatment plan? What are the main stats we need to know? You know, U equals U. Hit me with it.
Yeah, so most people, I think there's like this huge regime of treatment that I'm taking like 60 tablets a day. I take one pill, which is a combination of three drugs. So because HIV is quite a complex virus, you attack it in three ways. But this tablet has developed so much over the years. There's about 7 different brands and combinations you can get. But most of them is a one pill combination. That one tablet basically suppresses the level of the virus in your blood to a level that they call undetectable. So in the UK, what they say, I think it's like a cubic millimeter of blood, there is less than 50 copies of the virus. So it cannot be detected in normal tests. So they call it undetectable. What that actually means is the level of the virus is that low, you can never pass it on. So whether that's through having sex, sharing needles, or even giving birth, there's a small risk still with breast milk, but you can breastfeed. It's just there is still a little bit of a risk. But effectively, if you are on treatment and you take it correctly, you can never pass on the virus.
So that's undetectable equals untransmissible. I have a
yeah,
word.
That's what, yeah, so most people just call it U equals U.
And how did it feel to get this knowledge from the medical professionals that you got help from? How did it feel to know that this was actually your future, that once you took a pill and, you know, religious took it at the same time and maintained, you know, contact with your doctors, that you could go back to just basically living life like before?
Yeah, so most people, I think, refer to it as this magic pill. So obviously, we're not that far from the 80s. It wasn't that long ago. But the fact we've now got one tablet so strong and fantastic that you can basically live a normal, healthy life. I needed it immediately. So as soon as I was explained on the first day that this tablet existed, I was like, give it me now. Some people do have the opposite opinion still, because it's a daily reminder is what some people have in their head, that every day is this constant reminder that you are HIV positive. To me, I find it quite empowering, because this tablet has changed my life. It's let me live a normal life, a happy life, potentially a longer life than other people. So obviously with HIV, you get a full blood test once every 6 months. We call it an MOT when you're HIV positive, is what you refer to it as. It basically means that any disease or condition I get would be flagged up at a 6-month test. So the likelihood is I could outlive a lot of people on the basis my healthcare is so fantastic.
That's amazing. So why do you think it's so important to you to spread this message as well, to kind of beat the stigma, just educate people as well, if, again, they have these preconceived notions of HIV treatment not moving on since the 80s?
Yeah, so although the treatment has come a really far way, the stigma is exactly the same as it was in the 80s. So there's still a lot of connotations that HIV is a gay disease. A lot of people don't realise it. It basically, a new diagnosis, so there's a big mission by 2030 to completely eradicate new transmissions of HIV in the UK. And we are very on track to do that. But in order to reach that goal, everybody has to know about undetectable, because you need to know what your status is. And if you have HIV, you need to be on the medication. If you don't do those two things, so if you don't get a test and you're not on medication, we can never reach a stage of eradication in the UK. So it's so important. Most people in my community, so I think when I date or I speak to some of my friends, had no idea U equals U even existed. I didn't have any idea it existed. And I think it's because a lot of the kind of HIV media and the way it's kind of pointed out to people is that only people that think they're affected read it. So if you don't think you're going to be affected by HIV, why would you ever look and listen? So it's really important that we get that message out to a wider audience so that we can work towards achieving no new transmissions.
You mentioned the stigma that still exists. Is that why you felt reluctant telling your friends and peers? How long did it take you to start telling people?
Yeah, so I did tell my mum and dad, obviously, immediately, but I was 2 weeks shy of university and I went into that Freshers Week without telling anyone. And I felt a lot of pressure at that point because it kind of felt like I was living a lie, but I was also carrying this huge burden. Like the first few months of diagnosis are quite difficult because you're coming to terms with all the ideologies you have in your head not being true. Like I thought I was going to die and I'm not. I thought I could never have sex and I can. So when I eventually started telling my friends, I had an expectancy that their knowledge would be just as bad as mine, which wasn't the case at all. I was really lucky that the first couple of friends that I told were fantastically supportive. I've had people afterwards that haven't been that great, or there's a lot of people that feel the need to tell people. So I think when you're first diagnosed, I don't want anyone to know other than the people I've told, because I'm sharing a certain level of detail to the story that you equals you, I've got these tablets, that isn't always passed on. I think it can be so commonly just tied down to Ellie's got an STI, which isn't really the message you want to be passing when you're feeling that distressed.
Yeah, and you mentioned that someone at your university found out, and you had people in your lectures and other people on your course basically react quite negatively to you. Do you know how they found out, and can you tell me a bit about that experience of people finding out?
Yeah, so in Freshers Week, a boy had tried it on with me. Obviously, at that stage, I wasn't fully undetectable. I'd only been diagnosed for about 2 weeks. I'd also not had any encounter with men afterwards. And I found that whole experience quite distressing. So at that stage, I did tell him, and he was probably one of the first people I told. I've gone through the motions of saying, please don't tell anyone. And I kind of expected that nobody had told anyone. So it wasn't until 8-9 months into university, I was at the pub one day and one of the rugby boys had come over and he kept questioning if I was okay. And it was in a very intrusive way to suggest he definitely knew something, to which I basically realized it wasn't just him that knew, a very large amount of people knew. And I think what had happened, so when I at that point had pulled everyone in to say, guys, can we just stop talking about it? It's not very pleasant. What they've all gone and done is go back to their separate houses and try and have conversations of, oh, we need to stop talking about it. In doing that, what they've done is loudly spoke about it in front of everyone in their house. So by telling everyone not to speak about it, they were spreading it even further, which to me just felt like I'd lost entire control of my story, because they weren't saying anything about how well I've done, how fantastically I'm living, how I'm not getting this distressed by it, and I've really kind of taken my life back. They were just saying, Ellie's got HIV, which to me just felt like a huge robbery of all the hard work I'd put into being okay.
Yeah, 74% of people have experienced discrimination or stigma because of their status, and this is something you've unfortunately had to deal with. You mentioned the stigma as well being prevalent in your dating life after you did start, you know, opening up on dates after your diagnosis. What kinds of ignorance have you had to deal with?
Yeah, I think it's a really weird one. So this year will be my 5-year anniversary of living with HIV. At the start of my diagnosis, I would take my time to tell people. So I'd kind of wait until like the second or third day and then I'd bring it up. But what that would mean is I had a bit of a connection, and if they reacted badly, I was going to potentially get upset. So there's some people that will just block you straight away. There's some people, I've been called very horrible words in very public places by men, which isn't exactly nice. There's a connotation that I've got it from having sex with thousands of people, which again, just isn't the case. And I think people just still don't think that there's stigma. But a lot of people just saying things like, I've had people in passing say to me now since they've been public, oh, well, everyone knows. And I was like, but that's not a nice way to say it. You're implying that like everyone knows something bad about me. It's weird. So the gay community, the stigma exists, but it's not as bad because they are so well knowledgeable. In obviously PrEP is available and a lot of them are on PrEP. So PrEP is a tablet you can take pre-exposure to basically mean you never contract HIV. Because of that kind of advancement, a lot of gay men are fully aware of how it's transmitted and the fact that there's tablets. Straight people are still completely ignorant to the fact they can catch it. And therefore, I don't just have to tell people I've got HIV. I have to explain what HIV is to them.
And is this part of the reason you decided to post a YouTube video about your diagnosis and being HIV positive on YouTube and Facebook?
Yeah, so what happened is, so when my dad called Terence Higgins on the first day, after they got off the phone, he looked at my mum and said, one day she's going to be really good at talking about this. And he always said it to me. And I think in the back of my mind, I'd always thought, it's something I now feel incredibly strongly about. Like, being a HIV activist is a passion of mine, and I love spreading this message. And there was a lot of people in my personal life that I guess didn't know and I felt should know. So I recorded a video for World AIDS Day in 2021. And I was too scared to post it. So I got really drunk and posted it at midnight on World AIDS Day on my personal Facebook. So then I've completely forgotten I've done it, woken up hungover to like 700 messages. And I was like, oh God, what's happened? But everyone was actually fantastic. The response was so overwhelmingly great from people I've not spoken to in years, or just like friends of friends who have shared the video and seen it, that I then was like, I have to put this video somewhere bigger, which is why I decided to kind of move it over to the public platform and put it on YouTube.
And what kind of things did you say in the video? Did you just tell your story? Did you smash some stigma?
Yeah, so it's weird. In a lot of my videos, I don't talk about my story specifically at all. What I talk about is the story of what it feels to live like it and how it felt when I got diagnosed. And I also go through all of the stigmas and myth busting of you can't catch it from kissing. People still think you can get it from sitting on a toilet seat or sharing a mug. And I went through all this. I explained kind of the statistics. So because the transmissions are dropping in the UK, for the first time ever, heterosexual transmission, so obviously opposite sex, is catching up to gay transmission. I think it's just overtaken it, which a lot of people aren't aware of. They still think that it's massively dominated by gay men. But new transmissions now mainly sit in the heterosexual community.
Yeah, you've had, you gave examples of, you know, going in to give a talk and going in with a man and most people assuming that he was there to give the talk and you were his assistant because you are a straight woman. What's that like? What's been like being an activist in a space that it's not like you're not really represented?
Yeah, so I actually did a really fantastic talk a couple of weeks ago at a hospital down south. And I went with two other gay men who also do this. It's called Positive Voices. So it's a group of HIV positive people talking about their experiences. And it was quite strange because there was me and one of my really good friends who we've only been diagnosed. I think he was a couple of years before me. And then there was an elderly man who'd been diagnosed, obviously, years back, kind of in the 90s, early noughties. So you really had quite this breadth of people sitting there. You had someone who's had it for years, a gay man who's got it recently, and then a straight white woman who's got it recently. And it was quite overwhelming, the amount of questions that were then specifically directed at me. And I think that is because there's a lot of people in that room, although it's at a university hospital, that still think, wow, there's a girl here talking about this. How incredible.
Yeah. And you mentioned that, you know, you know other people who are HIV positive through your activism in day-to-day life. You don't really meet anyone who has it. What's that been like? You know, you don't, I suppose you've got people to talk to now and that's helped, but has it been quite lonely as well?
Yeah, I think I'd come to this kind of incorrect conclusion that I was the only young straight white girl living with HIV. And I'd convinced myself, although I knew other women had it, in my head, the only women I'd been exposed to were kind of 30, 40, 50 and over. So I was like, I always sit in a room and think, why me, when I'm sat around all these gay men? And that's self-stigma that I'm causing, because that is me still thinking it's a gay disease. And what I do now is kind of, I've met thousands of people kind of across the globe, which is really nice. But I've also met a very small handful of girls that would never want to share their story or be public about it, but have approached me through social media and been like, watching your stories made me feel better. And I always go back and go, but speaking to you makes me feel better, because it makes us realise that we're not alone.
Is that the kind of response? Did you get people reaching out after your piece with Metro saying the same? Or what kind of response did you get to the article you wrote with us?
Yeah, I think there's always going to be a mixed bag. There's going to be a handful of people that want to say negative comments. And I think you just have to take that on the chin and kind of push past it. But I'd say 90% of the feedback I've had kind of from my peers when I've shared it just around either work or through my friends is fantastic. But also the wider audience, I very publicly leave like my Instagram handle and say, if anyone wants to speak, please come and message me. And I've had so many people message me going, this has made me feel better. Or weirdly, one of my really great friends now, we met because he watched my YouTube video and messaged me on Instagram. And now I hang out with him all the time. He's one of my great mates, which I never would have thought would have happened from just posting a video online about my HIV story.
So one of the main comments underneath the piece you wrote for us was people perpetuating stigma, or the kind of blame that comes with an HIV diagnosis. People being like, oh, they've got this because they've engaged in behaviour that puts them at risk. What do you want to say to that?
Yeah, so the huge stigma around it is that there is good HIV and bad HIV. So good HIV is if you've got it early on in the 80s, 90s for a blood transfusion, that's fine, that's okay. Or vertical transmission, so when a mother has passed it to the baby, which luckily now that's basically almost eradicated in the UK. So if you fall pregnant modern day age now, HIV is one of the tests they will do. So if you don't know you're positive, they'll test you for it and get you on treatment. And then as long as you're undetectable, you cannot pass it to a baby now in the UK. You can also get it from, there's a very small group of people, obviously, got it from sharing needles, so anything intravenous, whether that's steroids or drugs. And then there's the really bad HIV, as people call it, from having sex. No way of contraction really matters in terms of someone living with it. We all face the exact same stigma and it does not matter. And I think a lot of times when people disclose how they got it, you open yourself up with this world of, oh, well, you deserve it, which is never the case. Living with HIV isn't something to be ashamed of and it's nothing to feel dirty about. Even if it was the bad form of HIV, everyone's had sex. It's not the end of the world. So I think it's really debunking that and making sure people don't stigmatize kind of the levels of contraction.
And in your piece as well, it's important, like, you're not disclosing how you got HIV. And the thing is, it doesn't matter. Like, to readers don't have the right to demand you tell them how you contracted HIV. And also, it doesn't matter, as you say.
So one of the really interesting things that people always talk about now, so there's a lot of media articles about cures. And some people living with HIV will jump at the opportunity to try and get that. I feel quite opposite. I've really accepted my status. But I also feel like if there was a cure and I took it tomorrow, I'm still HIV positive as far as I'm concerned. I have this massive wealth of lived experience that isn't going to go away by curing it. It's the same with, I guess, cancer is quite similar. Just because you go in remission doesn't mean you never had cancer. And I think that's what HIV is to me. It's not something I'm running to try and treat and get rid of. 100%, if there's something that I could do to make my health better, I would. But I don't feel the stigma is that bad that we should be forcing people to think the cure is the only option.
And you talked a bit earlier in the podcast how, you know, when you first were diagnosed, you felt dirty. How did you change your way of thinking to be the amazing activist and HIV positive spokesperson that you are now?
Yeah, so it took me years, if I'm honest. And I think a lot of that now, when I look back retrospectively, is because I shielded myself from anyone living with HIV. I didn't go to any support groups. I didn't reach out to charities for help. I just did it on my own for a really long time. And then there's a couple of really famous activists. So there's some people that put it on TikTok and I saw a couple of videos. There's Nathaniel Hall, who wrote a play because he contracted it from having sex. The first time he had sex is when he got it. And he's wrote a big play about it, which is fantastic. And I think seeing all these people talk about it kind of gave me the gumption to be like, I want to speak about this too.
That's amazing. So it really does help. It's really helped you listening to other stories. And as you said, you were one of the people that wanted as much information as possible. And you can get that from listening to other people's lived experience.
Yeah, so I think it's just knowing, and I do it now. I've recently become a peer mentor. So what it means is I will help newly diagnosed people. And I think that's such a fantastic thing. And I wish I'd have done it when I was first diagnosed. Meeting someone with HIV is very different when they say you're going to be okay than when the doctor says it. Because a lot of times, although the doctor does genuinely mean it, you're looking at him going, you get paid to tell me that. Whereas when you've got someone just living this normal, happy life and explaining to you, it's going to take some time, but we'll get you there, just carries a lot more volume.
Do you have any, like, one message you would like listeners to take home?
Yeah, so the biggest thing I always talk about when I do talks is, through living with HIV, I have learned so much about what I can't pass on. So I cannot pass on the virus. But I think you also pick up a lot of things that you cannot pass on stigma, you cannot pass on judgment in other people's lives. And then on the flip side of that, what you can pass on. So I think if there's anything people take away from this, you need to think about that you can pass on, that you should always get a regular STI test if you're having sex or you think you're at risk. You should pass on the fantastic message that you equals you. And then just be kind. I think a lot of people will watch this and still want to comment things about how I got it. There's just no need. I think if we all just stay positive, as my dad would say, we'll all have a little happier life.
Thanks for listening to my platform and to Ellie's experience. Please leave us a rating and a review. It really helps people to find the podcast. Our main aim with this podcast is to give a platform to underheard voices, offering a human first story to accompany some of the most prevalent topics in the news. We'd love to hear if Ellie's story helped shape your view. If so, please let us know on Twitter at Metro Opinion or by email at platform@metro.co.uk. My platform is produced by Pineapple Audio Production. I'm Jess Austin. Thanks for listening.